Welcome back, folks. Welcome back. We're going to continue stocks with transactions and transaction costs and market indices, benchmarks, measurements. But first, let me ask you a question. Did you review the first presentation? Yeah, folks, we got to notice stuff. Slide number 34. Bull markets versus bear markets. Now, you've heard the things, right? Are we in a bull market? Are we in a bear market? What are they? A bull market is a favorable market, normally associated with rising prices, investor optimism, economic recovery, and government stimulus. Yippee! Yippee! We're all making money! Yippee! Yippee! A bear market is an unfavorable market, normally associated with falling prices, investor pessimism, economic slowdown, and government restraint. Are we in a bull market or a bear market? Well, it depends on who you ask. We have yet to hit the max, the top of the market that was last recorded in 2007, I think October 2007 or so. So we're technically still in a bear market, but we're coming out of it, or at least we have been, since the bottom of the market in March of 2009. But it has been not a straight up ride. It's been fairly bumpy. And no one knows the future, but it sure looks as though it's going to continue to be bumpy for some time. Now, where did the terms bull market and bear market come from? Well, most people will tell you these are the reasons. Bulls charge ahead. They throw up their opponents into the air with their horns, right? Bears are reclusive. And when they do, which means they hide, and when they do attack, they knock down their opponents with their claws. I don't know if they're the real reasons. There's an old saying from the early 1800s, the bearskin jobbers. Don't sell the bearskin before the bear is caught. And supposedly that's the real origin of bear market. And you're free to look it up and see if you can understand it, because I can't figure it out. Slide number 35. Let's turn our attention to stock transactions. Now, this is covered in detail, in far too much detail, as far as I'm concerned, in Chapter 2. We'll cover Chapter 2 in detail at the end of the semester. But you do want to know that there are different types of stock transactions. By far the most popular and the one I suggest that you use for most of your transactions, obviously you're going to decide for yourself, is the market order. You want to buy 100 shares of a certain stock, you tell your broker or you type it in online, I want to buy 100 shares of Merck, the drug company. Or I want to sell 100 shares of Pfizer, the other big drug company. And whatever the price is at the current time that you place the order, that's the price you're going to get. But you have choices other than market orders. You can use what is called a limit order, which says, you know what, I want to buy a certain stock, but I don't want to pay more than a certain amount. So I will set a limit order that says I will buy this stock when it reaches 25. It's now at 27. So it has to fall down to 25. And the same thing is true on the sell side. I'll sell my shares, but not until they reach $30 a share. They're currently at 27. Now, what's the problem? Yeah, you might never get the shares. They might never reach your limit. And then there are other types that are similar to the limit order, and that's two of them are called the stop loss order. Sometimes it's called a stop order. Excuse me for the mouse here. You buy or sell at the current price once a trigger point is reached. But then what happens, folks, is it becomes a market order. So you might say, well, how's that different from a limit? Well, The difference is you hit that target, that trigger, and then it becomes a market order. So you're not guaranteed to get that price that you asked for. So you say, yeah, I'll buy it when it hits 25. But if it touches 25, now you have a market order. If it bounces back up, you're going to have to buy it at $25.50 or whatever it bounced back up to. And the same thing is true on the stop limit on the other side. You buy or sell the stock once the trigger point is reached, but you will only buy it or sell it at that price. Although you can use limit orders to buy or sell at the price you want, and stop loss and stop limit orders to lock in profits or protect against losses, remember that they trigger automatically. If for some reason you change your mind, it is often too late to cancel the order. And some people say, what's the difference between a limit and a stop limit? What's the difference between what? Don't worry too much about the differences. Just understand, because they're subtle. They're subtle, and some are used for buying, and some are used for selling. And just remember and understand that a market order is whatever the current price is, and these other choices allow you to say, I'm only going to pay this much, or I'll wait until it hits a certain point, and then I'll pay whatever the market is, or I will only pay this much or sell it for this much. Okay? Now, slide number 36 is from the book and tries to discuss the differences between the four. I normally use and I recommend market orders for people. Short-term traders tell me that they prefer limit orders or stop orders on all their trades. They say, oh, I want to make sure that if I lose a certain amount of money, they stop me out. That's what they said. I was stopped out, which means that's why it's sometimes called a stop loss, right? So say you bought this stock in the hope that it's going to go up to 30. You bought it at 27. But if it hits 25, sell. I don't care what price you give me, sell. And so can you see the problem? This can be dangerous, okay? Because what can happen is if the market falls for this stock precipitously, you think you're going to get 25. If it reaches 25, I want to sell it. But if the price falls to 20, that's the market order that's what you're going to get. That's what the current market is. So stop order becomes a market order. Yeah. I don't like anything that happens automatically. I want to know that I'm going to buy or sell the stock. I want to do it right now, get rid of it, or I want to buy it. So that's my bias. I tell you my bias right up front. But you'll talk to other people and say, oh, no, I always use limit orders. Oh, no, I always use stop loss orders. And that's all you have to know about those, okay? It's all you have to know. Slide 37. A couple other things from Chapter 2 are buying on margin and selling short. And again, we will discuss these at the end of the semester. Buying on margin means borrowing money from your broker to enhance your return. So, reading on slide 37, we see that you can borrow up to 50% of the purchase price of a stock. Huh? So say you want a stock that's $100. You could come up with only $50, and your broker is going to come up with the other $50. Now, wait a minute. Are they doing this out of the goodness of their hearts? No, they're going to charge you interest. And so what this allows you to do is make more money on a certain amount of money you have. It allows you to leverage your investment. Is there a downside? Oh, yes. If you lose, you lose even bigger than if you had just paid for it with cash. And selling short is the same kind of idea, but in reverse. Instead of borrowing money, we're going to borrow stock and sell it in the hopes that the price goes down and we buy it back later. Huh? You sell stock that you do not own? That doesn't sound legal. Well, actually, it is legal, folks. What do you think the banks do with your money? You put your money in the bank. Do you think they just sit on it? No, they lend it out. Well, the same thing is true for shares of stock. The brokerage firms will lend out the shares of the stock. And you as an investor, actually a trader, a speculator, because you don't invest when you sell short, folks. It's very dangerous. You borrow the shares from somebody, sell them now, and buy them back later. Hopefully the price has gone down. So you've heard the old saying, buy low, sell high. Well, selling short is the exact opposite. You sell high, buy low. You see, it doesn't matter which order you do it in. As long as you buy it for a lower price than you sold it, you're going to make money. Well, what's the problem? Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to go down. It can go back up. It can continue to go up or go up, in which case you're losing money when the stock goes up. Huh? Yeah, it's a mirror. Everything is reversed, and we'll go in detail. We'll talk about this in detail much later on. But let's read the... Oops, I did it again. There's the mouse again. This mouse is driving me nuts. My advice to you is never sell short. It's simply too risky. And we'll discuss this in detail later on. Using a margin account, buying on margin, can be useful once you have built a substantial portfolio because it allows you to borrow from your portfolio without having to sell your stocks. And as I said several times already, later, folks. This is all you have to know what is on this slide about buying on margin and selling short. Slide number 38. Now, let's discuss transaction costs, right? Because the brokers aren't doing it for their health. Traditionally, transaction costs were in the 1 to 5% range. Wow, that's pretty high. Sometimes higher. Well, you pay 6% when you sell your house. The largest percentage of the cost was the broker's commission. But deep discount internet brokers have driven the commissions down to as low as $5. There's one brokerage firm that even offers free trades. Oh, wait a minute. How can a broker make any money on $5 or $7 a trade? Hang on a minute. But have transaction costs really gone down? The answer is yes, they have. But more and more the cost is now hidden from the investor. And especially the internet garbage brokers. Now, folks, those aren't my words. That was somebody I was talking to who, that's what he referred to them, the internet garbage brokers. And I thought, well, that's a little harsh. And then I learned when I understood what they were doing, I said, well, that's, yeah, I guess that is a kind of an... nasty name, but they are doing something kind of sneaky. Slide number 39. So here's an example. A deep discount internet broker offers trades for $7. We won't mention any names. It's Scottrade. In the fine print of the client broker agreement is included a provision for allowing the broker to solely utilize exclusive stock dealers and market makers. Now, remember from the previous session when we were talking about dealers and the casas de cambio, the quoted price is simply the best price available. But at any one time, there are dozens of prices quoted as dealers and market makers compete for buy and sell orders. The chosen dealer doesn't necessarily have the best price. So instead of paying $20, the investor might pay $20.05. You see, there are lots of people, but when it was face-to-face, screaming out different orders, and now it's all internet, they're all computerized. The investor sees the $7 commission on their confirmation. The investor does not see the extra $5 they paid on a $100 share price because of the extra 5 cents, because of the dealer's markup. Does that make sense? Yeah. You don't see that. Now, look at this slide right here. Slide number 40. The following disclaimer is included in each trade confirmation email from Scottrade. And at first they put it in uppercase. Anytime you read uppercase, folks, you got to know that they don't want you to read it. Why? Because it looks like they want you to read it. This is important, but it's harder to read all uppercase. That's just a truism for us, because so we tend to gloss over it. Scottrade Incorporated receives remuneration, that's a fancy word for money, for directing orders to particular broker dealers or market centers for execution. Such remuneration is considered compensation to the firm, and the source and amount of any compensation received by the firm in connection with your transaction will be disclosed upon request. Huh? What are they saying? What they're saying is they're getting a kickback. They are sending your orders to certain individuals who they have deals with, and is that dealer necessarily giving you the best price? You don't know. But they will tell you how much they're getting paid by that dealer if you ask them. They're not going to offer it. In Scott Trade's defense, at least they prominently disclose this relationship in every email they send you when you make a trade. Many others hide it in the customer agreement fine print, and the customers are never aware of the relationship. You didn't read all the broker-customer contract? You clicked on that little box that said you read it. Yeah. Slide number 41. The Securities and Exchange Commission says that your broker has a duty to seek the best execution that is reasonably available for its customers' orders. But that's not a guarantee. The SEC requires broker dealers to notify their customers if their orders are not routed for best execution. Typically, this disclosure is on the trade confirmation you receive after placing your order, right? That was slide 40. And this is an article for Investopedia, which is a website about investing. Cute, cute, cute. And determining whether or not a customer got best execution can actually be very difficult. Here is an example of the Securities and Exchange Commission trying to enforce the rules. So this is a law article, but it's not that hard to read, actually. And what they're saying is, folks, it's very difficult. Because what's happening is there's thousands of transactions going on at any one time. And I know the company I work for, this was the previous one, but they have the same back office, the same clearinghouse. I don't want to get into it, but they're the people who are behind the scenes. And I know that they give the best deal they can because I've watched them. Because we have, at the brokerage firm, we have the ability to watch the trades that they execute. They fly by. You have to keep your eyes open because they go on the screen, just fly by. And I know we'll put in an order for an odd number, like 117 shares or some odd number of shares. So I'll watch to see when our trade goes in. And sure enough, as it's flying by, I see, oh yeah, that's basically the best price that's available right now. Now, you don't get to see this unless you have to pay extra, I think. Obviously, you're not going to get it for free. But we're $29 a trade, you know, exactly. So we're not $7 a trade. So that's the problem, isn't it? You got to pay more to get that kind of. But I understand. Now, this is my understanding. I'm not quite sure, but I've called Schwab, and I've looked at their customer broker agreement. And I couldn't find anything in there, and the guy on the phone told me they don't do that. Schwab is pretty darn cheap now. I think they're down to $13 a trade. And they guarantee that they will find the best price available. I mean, they do their best too. Sometimes something slips in and they don't get it. But normally they're going to give you the best price, and they don't route their transactions to a specific dealer market maker. And so, what's the moral of the story? You gotta know what you're doing. You gotta know who you're dealing with and how they're making money. And, does that mean that Scott Trade or Ameritrade or E-Trade, are they bad? But no, they're not bad. They're giving you something a whole lot cheaper than everybody else. And they're also adding a little bit, but you don't see it and you can ask. Okay, I've talked long enough. Slide number 42. The Securities and Exchange Commission was, I haven't heard much about this lately, looking into making the costs more transparent, possibly showing the customer the difference between the dealer's price and the best price available at the time of the transaction, maybe even, gasp, showing the total cost of the transaction from the markup and markdown. So in other words, you paid $7 for the commission, $5 because of the markup. Needless to say, the deep discount brokers cried that it would drive up the cost of commissions and ultimately hurt the consumer, and the proposal died. So it is up to you to check if you are getting the best execution. But how can you, a loan investor, determine if you are getting the best price if even the SEC has trouble watching over the brokerage companies? You see? Yeah, right. You better know who you're dealing with. Slide 43. The round lot versus the odd lot. Technology has made this distinction almost meaningless. It used to be, because of the way brokers on the floor of the exchanges would do business, that they wanted you to sell your shares in 100 in round lots, and every round lot was 100 shares. So any 100 or multiple thereof. And why was that? Well, it was because of the way they conducted business. If a broker threw up his arm and pointed back at himself and yelled out 25, it meant, and all the other brokers understood this, that I will buy 100 shares at 25. If they yelled out 25 and pushed their hand away from themselves, pushed the hand toward the other brokers, it means I will sell 100 shares at $25 a share. Does that make sense? Yeah, it does make sense if you understand it. You watch it and you're going, what are they doing? And they're yelling out numbers and nobody's yelling out how many shares. If they say 2 at 25, it means they'll take 200 shares at 25 or sell 200 shares at 25, depending on whether they move their hand toward them or move their hand away from them. Now, those are round lots. If the customer wanted to sell or buy 17 shares, you see, not a round lot, an odd lot, then the broker had to say 17 shares at 25. So it just slowed the process down. You understand? So what the brokers used to do is they would charge what's called an odd lot differential. It was the extra cost of trading an odd lot. Traditionally, the odd lot differential was between 12.5 cents and 25 cents. Huh? Yeah, you don't want to know, folks, but I'll tell you. Stocks used to be traded in eighths of a dollar. Yeah, not anymore. Now, folks, it's typically less than 5 to 10 cents. It might even be a penny, because it's all electronic. Who cares? What's the difference between typing in 100 or typing in 17? Some people recommend against odd lot purchases because of the higher cost. It's not a big deal. On 10 shares, an odd lot differential may be a dollar. On 80 shares, it might be $4. Who cares? $4 on, you know, a transaction in the $1,700 range or the $7,000 range or the whatever. It's not a big deal. So don't worry about it. But you do have to know the difference. I mean, when I say don't worry about it, I mean don't worry about it when you're buying and selling your shares. If you want to buy one share of Google at whatever it is, $580, go right ahead, buy it. What I do want you to understand is the difference between a round lot and an odd lot, because we're going to come back to it later, if you can believe it or not. So remember, a round lot is 100 shares or a multiple of 100 shares. Odd lot is anything less than 100 shares. So slide number 44, reading price quotes. Well, depending on the source, different sources will contain some, all, or more of these statistics, and what are some of them? We'll discuss them in detail later, but some of them are self-explanatory. But always remember that the quoted prices are not the only prices available. At any one time, there are many prices available from many different dealers and market makers. Remember the casas de cambio with all the different prices for pesos and dollars. The quoted prices are the best prices available. Plus, are you looking at the current price? No. You're looking at the price 15, 20 minutes ago. Unless you pay extra, usually they charge it. Maybe they'll give you a deal for the first 30 days. They'll give you the real, they call them real time, as if there was unreal time. I don't know. But you're looking at the current price when you get the real time quotes. Otherwise, you're looking at the quote 15 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago. So there you go. If you go to the brokerage firm, they pay the extra $10 a month or whatever. No, they pay a lot more than that. So slide number 45. This is from your book, and it's a quote from the Wall Street Journal where they show you what the day's statistics are for stocks. And, of course, that's the previous days. And, oh, my God, you mean you actually wait until the next day to find out how much your stock is worth? How 20th century. Folks, the Wall Street Journal, the last, I don't even know, do they still, I don't know. All the other newspapers have given up. Why? Because nobody looks at them anymore. They go online for that. Yeah, so you don't go looking at the San Diego Useless Tribune for the stock quotes. It won't be in there anymore. They stopped about, I don't know, four or five years ago. Here is where you're going to look, right? Yes, the Infernal Net. And in the face-to-face class, I will show people the Yahoo. And that's what I use. And I don't own any stock in Yahoo, folks. I don't care which one you use. Just for me, it seems to be the easiest. And people tell me they like Bloomberg. I think Bloomberg has gotten better, definitely. I didn't like it at all when every square inch of the screen was filled, every square centimeter was filled up with chock full of information. Oh, it's too much. It's just too much. CBS MarketWatch actually has some pretty good commentators, but again, they stuff every little piece of space on that screen with too much information. The biggest reasons I use Yahoo are because I believe it is the easiest one to use, and it's also the easiest on the eyes. The newer version is actually harder on the eyes, in my humble opinion, and I complained bitterly, but they're not changing it back. However, some of the other sites have started to add more white space. Why is that? White space is easier on the eyes. Believe it or not, you would think it would be the other way around, but your eyes gravitate to the open areas. And I literally recoil from the sites that fill every square centimeter with information. Note to the online students, please see the accompanying presentation on how to use Yahoo Finance to do your research. But again, you don't have to use Yahoo Finance. You use the one that you like best. I have a friend who uses Big Charts. Big Charts. I didn't think it was very good at all. And then the one that's conspicuously underwhelming is Google's Finance. Try it out. It's not very good. But you might like it. Who knows? And in fact, Google has sort of made fun of their own finance website, saying that it's really nothing to write home about. Slide 47. Okay, so you're going to use Yahoo or Bloomberg or CBS MarketWatch, or if you want to look in the newspaper, go right ahead, to do one of the problems, one of the assignments in Chapter 5. Very cool, very cool. Slide 47. Now, let's turn our attention to market averages and market indexes. We've already discussed these things. Actually, a lot when we discussed index funds. We've discussed indices. And when we talked about historical returns. But now let's concentrate and understand these better, and we need to learn some. We need to memorize some. We can't memorize all of them. There are dozens and dozens now, hundreds of these things. But slide 47, let's read together. How can we say that stocks have returned approximately 10% or 11% over the past 70 years or 80 years or the 6% over the last 20, whatever it is? The industry uses market averages and market indexes. And another term for that is benchmark, measurement. The benchmarks are used to measure the general behavior of securities prices by reflecting either the average price behavior, that's a market average, or the relational price behavior, that's a market index, of representative groups of securities, stocks and bonds, and gold and real estate, but we're talking about stocks here, at any given point in time. You cannot help but hear about these things every day in the news. The Dow went down, the Nasdaq went up. What are they? They're just lists of stocks. Now, we discussed on this slide a difference between market average and market index. And you know what? Most people don't even know that there's a difference, and you don't have to worry about it. Don't, because in general, almost all of them are market indices. The averages are few and far between, and they're not considered as good as indices, but it doesn't really matter because none of them are perfect anyway. So remember, average is the average price. Market index is a relational price behavior. But don't even have to remember it, because I don't think I'm going to ask you. If I do, I apologize. But yeah, slide number 48. The market average uses a share price calculation. Looks solely at the price of the stock without regard to the market value. And there's really only one industry average that is followed closely, and that's the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The granddaddy of them all, started in 1896 by Charles Dow. Yeah. The others, important ones, are market-weighted calculations. These are market indices. Stock price times the number of shares outstanding. What is that calculation? We're going to come back to that calculation later on. That's how much the company is worth. It takes into account the market value of the stock in the index. In other words, a company like Exxon is a whole lot more important than a company like, what's a small company based here in San Diego that you may have heard of? Vagabond Inns. Right. We talked about them in the last presentation. Vagabond Inns, a little hotel chain. So the larger the market share, the more influence the security will have in that index. You understand? It kind of makes sense, doesn't it? A company such as Walmart and Apple and Procter & Gamble, another very large company, well, they're a whole lot more important because they're just so much bigger than companies, smaller companies, that, you know, you may have heard of, you may have not heard of, but they're small. And market-weighted calculations were generally regarded as a better measure until the bubble of late 1990s, when it turned out that, you know, sometimes even market-weighted indices can get messed up. And the reason we don't worry too much about the distinction is because the only important market average is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And all of the companies in the Dow Jones Industrial Average are very large. So it doesn't matter that you're comparing all these companies just on price and not on how large they are. It would matter if you were doing it in the S&P 500, because the top 10 companies are huge compared to the bottom 10 companies. Does that make sense? Do you understand why it's not that important to worry about? Because only one important one, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, uses average price, and all the companies are big. And all the others say, well, we need to take into account the fact of how big every company is. Okay, that's enough said about that. Slide 49. So now let's enumerate the more important ones, and we will end with a worksheet that you'll go through on your own, and there's a commentary and an answer key, and the worksheet, on the worksheet are the indices that I want you to memorize. Those are the important ones. Because on these next few slides, you're going to see a ton of indices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Dow Average, the most famous of stock market measures. The stock market average made up of 30, so if you remember, if you hear 30, you know that's the Dow, high quality stocks selected for total market value and broad public ownership and believed to reflect overall market activity. It doesn't, because they're all large companies. It doesn't tell you how the small companies are doing or the mid-sized companies, but that's all right. It changes from time to time as companies and industries evolve. And as such, it now has more non-industrial stocks than industrial stocks. That's why it's often just called the Dow, because it's not really an industrial average. Dow Jones is the company that publishes the Wall Street Journal. A few years ago, Rupert Murdoch of Fox News bought Dow Jones. And he paid approximately $2 billion more than what people thought it was worth. The general consensus was that it was worth about $3 billion, and he said, I'll give you $5 billion. Remember, the Dow Jones was Dow Jones company was privately held. It was a big family that all owned shares in this, and it sort of tore the family apart, because there were several people who did not want Rupert Murdoch to own the Dow. Well, if you watch Fox News, you'll know why. They call it faux news because it's not really a news; it's a propaganda channel. And I apologize for anybody who I've stepped on their toes who actually believe that every word of Fox News is the absolute god-awful truth. But, and so he didn't care. I don't care. I'm spending $2 billion more. He wanted Dow Jones. And he's not even an American. Figure that one out. Slide number 50. Here they are, folks. There's the 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And most of these you've heard about. Alcoa, Aluminum Corporation of America. American Express. AT&T, the new AT&T, the old AT&T was kicked out. Bank of Armenia, America, Boeing, what's Boeing? Some of you don't know, but most of you know. Is that right? Planes, the big defense contractor and jumbo jets, Caterpillar, tractors, Chevron Oil, Cisco. There's two Ciscos. There's S-Y-S-C-O, which makes food and uniforms and stuff like that. And then there's Cisco, C-I-S-C-O, which makes internet equipment. Yeah. Coca-Cola, Disney, DuPont, that's a chemical company. ExxonMobil, General Electric, Hewlett-Packard, Home Depot, IBM, Intel, Johnson & Johnson. You know Johnson & Johnson. Band-Aids, right? Tylenol. J.P. Morgan Chase, the financial firm. Kraft Foods, Velveeta cheese. McDonald's, Merck, that's a drug company. Microsoft, Pfizer, another drug company. Procter & Gamble, what do they make? Procter & Gamble, I don't know. Oh, yeah, the soap, shampoo, Pringles. Actually, they sold Pringles. Pampers and toilet paper. What's the Charmin? 3M, what a silly name. Minnesota Mining and Materials, Post-it Notes, Scotch Tape, Travelers, that's an insurance company and financial firm, United Technologies, that's a conglomerate of industrial, that's really an industrial stock, Otis Elevators, Pratt and Whitney Jet Engines, yeah, Verizon, telephone company, Walmart, so there they are. So when you hear that the Dow went down 100 points, what they did is at the end of the day, as the day goes on, they do it all the time, they add up all the prices and divide by 30. Well, it's a little more trickier than that because of splits and mergers and the like, but still, that's what happened. So when you're talking about the Dow, you're talking about those 30 stocks. And the problem with the Dow, and the problem with all of them, but especially the Dow, is that they move stocks in and out. And for example, a worksheet that I'm going to have you, I want you to do on the website 77 years ago or 78, where are we? That asks you which one would you choose, right? And what you'll see on that document are the companies that were replaced by these current companies. Obviously, Cisco wasn't around 77 years ago, or Walmart. And so, who did you own, or who was there beforehand? And you start to understand that these things are very imperfect because they didn't put Microsoft and Intel into the Dow until 1999, right before the internet bubble burst. Right? And then they didn't get rid of GM and AIG until they were in bankruptcy. So you see, when people say, the Dow hasn't done anything in 12 years, yes, it has, yeah. But the same companies that were in the Dow 12 years ago are not in the Dow anymore. So you can't really compare what it was like 10 or 12 years ago with what it was now because it's not the same index. So you see why we say they're imperfect measures at best? Yeah. But, so I want you to do that document. Make sure you do that. Let's continue because it's all we've got. Slide 51. Here's an interesting little slide, and what are we doing here? What we're seeing is that there are times in the marketplace and in the economy when things go well, and there are times when things don't go that well. So from 1906 to 1924, the Dow went from 100 to 100. Now, did it stay 100? No, it went up and down and bounced around. So basically, as people will say, it didn't do nothing for 20, almost 20 years. Well, that's not true. It did a lot. And remember, they pull stuff out and put stuff in. And then from 24 to 29 in the roaring 20s, it went from 100 to 300. So it jumped three times. And that was the bubble of 1929, the crash of 1929, the Great Depression. And it didn't recover to 300 until 1954. In between, it went down and then back up and then down and went back up. So it didn't make it back to 300 until 1954. 25 years. Now, does that mean people didn't make any money in the stock market for 25 years? That's not the truth. All they're saying is the prices of those stocks, right, didn't recover. And remember, some of them disappeared and some of them reappeared. And then from 1954 to 1966, it went from 300 to 1,000, another rise of three times. And then from 66 to 82, it went down and then back up to 1,000 and then down and then back up to 1,000. A total of 16 years where it did nothing. Well, did it do nothing? No, not at all. And then from 1982 to 2000, the great run-up, the globalization, look at that, from 1,000 to 1,100, 11 times. And since then, from 2000 to 2011, well, it's now over 12,000, but in 2011 it hit 11,000. But in the meantime, it went up over to 14,000, back down to what, 6,000, back up to 11,000, then back down to 9, and now it's up to 12. So you might be tempted to say, well, how long is it going to take to do this? How do you make money in stocks during times when the markets and capital gains are flat? And there are several answers, but two big ones. The answer depends upon whether you are an investor or a speculator slash trader. You see, the speculator trader would say you go with the trend. You sell when prices are falling, you buy when prices are rising. You try to time the market. You use whatever metrics you need, whatever methodology you can find to buy low and sell high. An investor would say, I'm going to concentrate on dividends. I'm going to buy shares at reasonable prices, and yes, they're going to bounce around, but I'm going to watch those dividends. And of course, there's a mixture of both. It's not an either-or situation, and there are other methods too. But think about that, folks. Where are we? And when will we ever have another big... I don't know. In the meantime, we concentrate on buying good quality companies and cashing our dividend checks. Next slide. 52. Other Dow Jones averages. The transportation average. These are 20 railroads, airlines, freight. And many people watch this. Why? Because when the economy does well, exactly, stuff has got to move around, and so many people will watch this, and when it ticks up, they say, ah, might be a good sign. When it ticks down, oh, might be a bad sign. The utilities average, well, that's pretty straightforward. Utilities, are they going anywhere? No. And then you add the industrial, the transportation, and utilities, and you get the Dow Jones 65 stocks composite average. Now, I don't know anybody who really follows that one too much. The next one is actually pretty important. Why? It's because many index funds use this. The Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. What a dumb name. They just changed it, I think, last year. It used to be called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000 Total Market Index. Well, really, what it used to be called is the Wilshire 5000. Wilshire is a company that decided we want to have an index that measures the total stock market. So they came up with the Wilshire 5000. And then several years ago, they started calling it the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000. So I thought, and I didn't do my research. I assumed that Dow Jones had purchased Wilshire. No, they had made a deal that they would throw their name in there. I don't know what happened, but I read that just recently. And then Dow Jones figured, well, we don't want to deal with Wilshire anymore. We'll do the same thing, but we'll call it the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index, which I think is a horrible name, but that's what they use. And what you will see when you go to Vanguard and other companies that are big on index funds is you will see the total stock market, the U.S. total stock market index fund. So it's using those 5,000 stocks. Now, it's not 5,000 stocks. It started out 5,000, went to 7,700, went down to 6,300, then 57, and then so it moves around. But these are the big companies, the medium-sized companies, and the small companies. So the total market. The next one may look familiar because if you've done the Chapter 4 assignment for the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan, that's right, that's the S fund. There it is. The U.S. Completion Total Stock Market Index. Completion. It used to be called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000. Before that, it was called the Wilshire 5000. I'm sorry, the Wilshire 4500. I apologize. The Wilshire 4500. And where did they get this? They took the top 5,000 and got rid of the top 500. Those are the stocks in the S&P 500. So in other words, how do you measure the extended market? And that's what it's often called. You'll see an index fund that's called the Extended Market Index. Go look at Vanguard. They got it. I think Fidelity has it too. And so what they're saying is, how are mid-size and small companies doing? And what's happened is it's become fairly popular with index funds. I mean, the Thrift Savings Plan. How many employees does the federal government have? 2.5 million. And I think that includes the military. And then the Dow Jones Internet Index, which is a phenomenal example of bad timing. They come out with this Dow Jones Internet Index in, I think, 98 or 99. And it then proceeds to lose 96% of its value. Right, just as the Internet bubble exploded. So, slide number 53. The Standard & Poor's 500 Composite Index. Yes, the S&P 500. Does this look familiar, the S&P? Have we talked about this guy long enough when we were talking about index funds and historical returns? These are 500 stocks chosen for market size, liquidity, and industry group representation. It's a market-valuated index. So the bigger the company, the more clout it has, the more emphasis it has in the index. Traditionally, it was the largest 500 companies based in the United States. But now it can contain some foreign stocks. Now, why is that? Well, because of the way the world is now. British Petroleum bought Amoco, which is an oil company based in Ohio, I think. It's Ohio. It used to be Standard Oil of Ohio. And ARCO, Atlantic Richfield. Well, wait a minute. Those were two stocks in the S&P 500. So we just act like they disappeared. Daimler-Benz, Mercedes-Benz, bought Chrysler in, what, 97 or 98? We just decide that Chrysler's gone. So what Standard & Poor's did is just allow some foreign companies that are basically, you know, have a huge percentage of their company in the United States, or used to be a company based in the United States. They just, okay, we'll let Chrysler, what do they call it? Daimler-Chrysler, right. They're gone. They Daimler sold Chrysler a few years ago, but... And there was a joke when they were together. How do the Germans pronounce Daimler Chrysler? That was the name of the company, Daimler Chrysler. They pronounce the name of Daimler Chrysler, Daimler. The Chrysler is silent. Ha, ha, ha. Anyway. Yeah, very popular index, as we saw with index funds, but it's lost some of its original focus. Because the S&P 500 is market-weighted, it was affected by the bubble of the late 1990s in a bizarre manner. The market values of a small percentage of technology companies were inflated to extremes. For a while there, Microsoft was $500 billion. Cisco was $500 billion. Oracle was $500 billion. And this skewed the index even more toward those companies because the bigger they get, the more they are included in the index. You understand? It's market weighted. So the bigger you are, the more the index funds have to buy of you. The more the index funds have to buy your stock, the bigger you get. So it pumped up the balloon, and then you know what happened. When the tech bubble burst, it really clobbered the tech companies, and the S&P 500 lost almost 50%, the NASDAQ lost 80%. So in 1998, while this was happening, 10% of the gain of the S&P 500 was due to one stock, and that was Microsoft. So think about it, folks. It's an index of 500 companies, and one company was responsible for 10% of the gain. During this time in the late 90s, some of the old economy, now some of you were young, you were alive, but you probably weren't listening to what was going on. The new economy stocks like eBay and the internet companies and like Microsoft and Intel and Oracle and Cisco Apple was actually hurting at this time. They were in trouble. But those stocks were the ones everybody wanted to buy. AOL. You remember AOL? But the old economy stocks, the paper companies and timber companies and the oil companies and the real estate companies and the healthcare, we don't want those. That's old economy. I remember one investor telling me, oh, don't buy a REIT, a real estate investment trust. Nobody's going to be going to the shopping centers anymore. We're going to get all our groceries off the internet. Slide number 54. Oh, by the way, who is Standard & Poor's? Are the same people who wrote the book that you were using? They're part of McGraw-Hill. And slide 54, you see some of their other popular indices. The Industrial 400, the Mid-Cap 400, self-explanatory, Small-Cap 600. And then the Standard & Poor's 1500 is the 500 plus the 400, the biggest companies, the S&P 500. The mid-cap 400 and the small-cap 600. See, so they have their version of the total market index. And then there are dozens and dozens of transportation, utilities, financial, global, international sector indices. Go on S&P's website and they'll be happy to show you all the ones they have. Slide number 55. The New York Stock Exchange, the American Exchange, and the NASDAQ all have their indices. And the New York Stock Exchange Index is really not as popular as you would think it is. Most people look at the Dow and the S&P. The Amex is not that popular at all. But the NASDAQ is very popular. And why is that? Because remember, the NASDAQ is dominated by technology companies. So that's why you often hear news sources quote the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. And some of them don't even quote the S&P, which I think is more, personally, in my opinion, is a better measure than the Dow. Not that I think the S&P is that much better, it's just more companies, where the Dow is only 30 companies. So they'll quote the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. Yeah, and NASDAQ 100, not as popular. The NASDAQ composite, folks, talk about bubbles, went from 800 in 1995 to 5,000 in the year 2000, March of 2000. And then between March of 2000 to October 2009, it dropped 80% before it started to recover back in 2003. And as we said, the NASDAQ indices are technology laden. Slide number 56. Here, we're going to review the total stock market indices. Remember, these are other popular stock market indices. We already discussed the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. Also, or used to be called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000 Index, which used to be called the Wilshire 5000. They are now competing with S&P Total Market Index and the MSCI U.S. Broad Market Index. What's the big deal? I guess it's bragging rights. I'm not exactly sure if this is true or not. I don't know. But if a mutual fund uses that index, or says they use that index, I guess they got to pay the company. I don't know. I should find out. I really should find out. I often thought it just seems like a lot of silliness to me. But there's obviously a whole lot of competition. And who is MSCI? We'll get to them in a minute. The extended or completion stock market indices. There's the U.S. completion total stock market index. The Dow Jones Wilshire 5000 also used to be called the Wilshire 40. I'm sorry. I said 5000 again, didn't I? I apologize. The Dow Jones Wilshire 4500 used to be called the Wilshire 4500 and now competing with the S&P Completion Index, and I'm sure MSCI has one too. So you take the top 5000 and you cut off the top 500. So you get rid of the large company stocks. And we saw that was used by many index funds, including the Thrift Savings Plan. Slide number 57. the Russell 2000. And this was the older one. And some people still use it. This was the first one that came out to measure the small company performance. You see, Russell is another company that does this kind of stuff called Frank Russell Associates. And they start with the top 1,000, and then they overlay on top of that the top 3,000, and then they take away the top 1,000. And what you're left with is the 1,001 all the way to 3,000th companies. So you're left with the medium-sized and small-sized companies. So it's meant to measure small company performance in the United States. But it doesn't seem to be as popular with index funds, but it's definitely popular with market analysts. They'll say, you know, the Dow and the S&P are really hurting, but look at the NASDAQ and the Russell 2000. Small company and technology companies are doing really well. So you'll hear them talk about it. And now these indices, see, it used to be so much easier, but they just keep adding more and more and more. MSCI, Morgan Stanley Capital International. You don't have to remember that, folks. You do not have to remember that. But that's the company. And I'll give you a little bit of history. Capital is the real name of American Funds. Most people don't know that, and only people in the industry would know that. And American Funds was one of the first. They weren't the only ones, but they were one of the first mutual fund companies to go abroad. Templeton, and who else went abroad? T. Rowe Price. And so they needed some kind of benchmark. They needed some kind of S&P 500 for the world and for the international, outside the United States. So they created the Capital International Indices, and then they sort of scratched their head and said, you know what, it doesn't make sense for us to be doing this because we're measuring ourselves. You know, we're creating this index, and then we're measuring ourselves against this index. Not a smart thing to do, don't you think, guys? Yeah, probably not. So they sold it off to Morgan Stanley, but Morgan Stanley kept the name, Morgan Stanley Capital International, and now it's a separate company. Morgan Stanley sold it off, and now you can go to the MSCI website and find that they're their own company. And I think they're publicly traded. And they have the World Index. That's the global developed world. And that used to include, or still does include, the developed world. That United States, Canada, Europe, mostly Western Europe, and Japan. And a few others, but mostly the developed world. Well, folks, is that the world anymore? No. The developing world is doing great. Russia and Mexico and China and India and the Philippines, South Africa, Turkey, Peru, Brazil. So the MSCI All Country World Index, who came up with that name, is replacing the World Index, which now includes the developing world countries. You understand? So if your benchmark for your mutual fund that you're studying is the World Index, it probably says in the annual report somewhere that we're now also looking at the MSCI All Country World Index. Or they might have already replaced it. They might use both, they might have replaced it, or they might still be using the World Index. And the same thing is true for the EAFE, and that's how it's pronounced, don't ask me why, Europe, Australia, and the Far East. In other words, how are companies outside the United States doing? Again, that didn't include the developing world, so now the EAFE is being replaced by the MSCI All Country World ex USA Index. So what can I say? That's the name they came up with. They didn't ask me, and so that's the one you will see often if you were looking at an international fund. They'll compare themselves against the EAFE, and they'll compare themselves against the All Country World ex USA Index. And as we said, there are dozens and dozens of other ones. But stock worksheet number one, which I want you to do, and there's a commentary and there's an answer key, contains the indices that you should know by name. And let me see if I can remember them all. The Dow, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Dow Jones U.S. Total Market Index. I call it the Wilshire 5000 still. The Dow Jones U.S. Completion Total Market Index, I call it the Wilshire 4500. And the Russell 2000, MSCI World, being replaced by MSCI All Country World Index, and MSCI IFA, All Country World XUSA. So they're on the worksheet, so you don't have to write all those down and listen to me talk about them too quickly. But those are the ones I want you to know by name and memorize those. But obviously, I'm not going to ask you to memorize any more than that because there's just too many of them. Slide number 58. Every night when you turn on Nightly Business Report or go on CNBC or whatever news channel you watch or go online and look at the graphs, this is what you're going to see. Oh my goodness, stock market index mania. The Dow Jones Industrial started at 12,777 and then skyrocketed up to 12,780 and then the bottom fell out of the market and it dropped to 12,760 and then ended the day pretty much where it started at 12,775. Today's unstable stock market. Well, anybody who knows anything about statistics, knows that this is not a real representation of what you're looking at. What did they do, folks? And they do this all the time, not just in the finance world. They cut off the origin. You don't see from 0 to 12,760. And that makes this graph look wildly unstable, doesn't it? Well, guess what? If they had showed you everything, now what we have is stock market index ennui. Do you know what ennui means? It's a French word. It means beyond boredom. Because if they showed you from zero to whatever, does it look like the market index moved at all? No. But are you going to see this graph on the nightly news? Not likely. No way. Yeah, right. But when you see the graphs that they splash across the screen, just remember the one I showed you, right? Now, slide number 60. This allows us to go back and re-examine volatility. So you remember the slide in the first presentation that showed you what happened to the S&P 500 in 2011? How it started off at 10,000 and went up to 10,500 and down to 90 and then basically ended up where it left off. If we had shown you the whole left side of the graph, would it have looked as scary? Yeah, so we were guilty of trying to scare your pants off too, weren't we? But when you look at the total amount, it doesn't look that bad, does it? Can you live with the market volatility? I think you can, especially when you put things in perspective. And there's a document on the website called, Keep a Long-Term Perspective. And by the way, you will never see this graph on the Nightly Business Report or the CNBC or the Fox channel or whatever. You just won't see it. They ain't going to show it to you. So what do you think? Excited? Go back over and review it again. Transactions and the cost of transactions, the market indices, do stock worksheet number 1, and I'll see you next time. Great class. Keep up the great work, folks. Don't give up. Never give up.